How do you build a high-performance team? That's the question that all leaders grapple with. The challenge in today's environment is that you're told to pull this off on a shoestring budget and that you have to exceed previous year's production. It's an impossible task. Here's how this show helps. Every week, we're going to feature executive and senior leaders from HR, IT, and sales, and they're going to share their best practices and playbooks so you can empower your managers to build great teams. We are Engaging Leadership, and now, here's the show. Thanks for joining us today. This is your friendly neighborhood talent strategy nerd, Dr. Jim. Trying to figure out how to convince people to stay in your organization is probably one of the most challenging tasks that a leader has. No one has it easy. When it comes to employee retention, it can be argued that no industry has a tougher task than the K-12 education space. Think about it. The hours are long, the pay isn't great, you have multiple stakeholders that you need to satisfy, and to top it all off, you have to deal with all sorts of external political pressures from folks that have no idea what the day-to-day life looks like for an educator. In the face of all of those constraints, there's still a good number of leaders in the K-12 space who are doing phenomenal jobs building great teams and building a retention culture. One way to help tip the scales in your favor is to be laser focused on the first 90 days of a hire and to embed flexibility, autonomy, and a listening culture into your organization. That's the argument that Scott Foster, superintendent of the Northland Pines School District, makes. So how did he and his team pull this off? What's his story? Scott's a 30-year educator with 18 years as an administrator, including the last six as the district administrator for the Northland Pines School District. The school district is a rural district in northern Wisconsin, serving approximately 1,300 students, and covers almost 500 square miles and maintains three campuses. Scott has led the district through one-on-one initiatives, opening multiple charter schools, changing pay models, changing school calendars, bringing forward a district continuous improvement cycle, and has done all of this through ever-changing times. So we're in for a great story. Scott, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Jim. I appreciate being here and sharing our story.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to this discussion. This is part of a special series that we're doing on the K-12 education space and particularly leadership best practices. And I know we're going to cover a lot of ground in the discussion, but before we do that, I think it's important for you to share with us and the audience some details about the district that you're in. Paint us a picture of what you are facing on a day-to-day basis.
We are located in far northern Wisconsin. We actually border the UP of Michigan. So we have a distance and location. As you mentioned, we're 500 square miles with three campuses. We have 22 buses every day covering lots of miles because it is considered God's country with lakes and trees, but that also adds the challenges of high transportation costs, kids riding buses up to an hour, and really finding that balance of how do we educate them at a high level, but yet manage a budget in a state where school finances are tight. And also we have taxpayers with high poverty. So it's a balance between creating our kids to make world-class education, but yet doing it in a environment that's very unique.
A lot of what you said is interesting, and it gives us a really good overview into the district. I think one thing that I'm curious about is when you're looking at the specific challenges within your district, geography being one of them, what's been your key in finding talent in the first place? Because I can't imagine that a lot of young educators would want to be in quote unquote a remote environment. And I might be overstating the remote bit, but you get where I'm going with this.
Yeah, I think you got to always work from your strengths. So one of our strengths is it's a great place to live. We have trees, lakes, bike trails, you name it. And I think our current generation is looking for that. On the flip side, you have to provide just the same things you would find in an urban district: high quality professional development, trust, high expectations, and great facilities. So it's finding that mix of somebody that wants to live in this area. Sometimes it's finding jobs for more than one. So if you have two professionals, is there opportunities for both of them? So it's the combination of find the person that's passionate to live in this area and have these unique things. To some may seem challenges, to others. The other thing we've gained over the last few years is our broadband has really expanded. And that's really opened the door to provide people to be able to work from home. So whether it's a spouse that's a professional or just showcase, you can live in the Northwoods, but have all the things you have elsewhere.
So I want to dig into that a little bit. And it's your point about you have to find people that are aligned with what the region offers. play to your strengths is, I think, the phrase that you used. So how does that show up in your recruitment strategy, in your interview strategy, and in your retention and development strategy?
Sure. Well, the obvious would be just how we describe ourselves in any kind of job posting. But more importantly, it's our website, our brochures. We have high quality professional made videos that showcase the area, but also showcase our outstanding facilities. We're very lucky that we have a middle and high school that's only 18 years old. All of our buildings are 30 years or less. We are very tech savvy here. We have had one-to-one for a very long time. We use technology to our advantage to bring forward all these opportunities. So it's really showcasing across the board. We really try to get staff here. The whole idea of doing virtual interviews, we'll do it in the last case scenario. But if I can get them in the door and see what we have to offer from people and facilities, it's usually a great hook.
So when you think about what you just mentioned and you apply it to maybe a school district that's in similar circumstances where they're rural, but they're not as modern as what you're describing, what are some of the principles that those rural districts that aren't as modern, what are some of the principles that they can take from what you're doing that will impact their ability to attract the right talent?
Yeah, we're definitely, obviously, a people business. So from day one, when we start the interview process, we really are catering them. It's phone calls, follow-ups, thank you, handwritten notes. Then when they come in the door and we finally get to the point where they agree to come join our family, I think those vocabulary terms such as family and other small pieces go a long ways. But then we keep in touch. Are they finding a place to live? Can we help with that? Are they ready to make the move? Do their spouse need a job? Can we help with that? It's really starting to build a relationship from day one, make sure they know what the plan is when they come. Having other staff members reach out, not just administrators, I think has gone a long way. I think any district with different facilities can do the human pieces of what we do here. And it has to be true and authentic. And I think that's the other thing. It can't be just, hey, here's an email. How are things going? It can be texts. It can be phone calls. I, as the superintendent, like to send handwritten notes. We want to keep that relationship going right up to the day the kids come.
I really like some of the grassroots or all hands on deck approach that you're talking about. When you look at all of those things, what's the impact of all of that? What's the feedback that you've gotten from the people that have been on the receiving end of that on how that shaped their perceptions and their desire to stick around?
We do a first-year mentor program where we do survey them at the end, because we want to keep improving that process. And what we hear a lot of is it's the whole package that made a difference to them. It is the other staff members. It is a principal or a director who does reach out to them and checks in with them. Not only how's it going in the classroom, but how are you doing? Is your family adjusting? Are you adjusting? Have you found professional companionship? And that's probably been one of our biggest challenges, is we don't have a group of young professionals. There are some groups that are forming. We try to facilitate and support that. We do that within the district, but then we're also looking for other opportunities with other districts or other professional groups to give our staff that opportunity. Because what we hear when it isn't successful is they're not finding those things for that they would find in a more urban or suburban area.
One of the things that I'm gathering from what you're describing is this intentional effort at building a pretty strong support system around anyone new that's coming into the district as an educator or administrator or whatever the case might be. And the reason why that stands out is that there's a lot of research that goes into the private sector that indicates that the better the onboarding process is for a new hire, the more likely you're going to have a positive retention outcome. Now, it's not a one-to-one relationship, but it certainly influences that. So tell us a little bit more about how you focused on that first 90 days of a new employee coming in. What are the things that you're doing that are specifically driving better retention outcomes? Because your district has some pretty good track record when it comes to retaining and developing teachers.
I've shared already what we do to get to that first 90 day, but we do assign a mentor. It doesn't necessarily just have to be somebody in the building or in the department, because we know some of that's going to happen already. So we want to add capacity. So we know they're going to be in department meetings. We know they're going to be classroom next door. So we try to pick the best teachers that we know are going to focus on all the things that a teacher may need. We have a very scripted mentor program. All mentors have to be certified and trained, and then we really focus on following through. We do have some administrators in charge of creating really neat, fun events. We've done some different things with picnics. We've done some things with, we have a local pirate ship that we're known for our lakes, so we take them out to know our community. We do a fun survey of our current staff, like where's the best fish fry? Where's the best pizza place in town? So we give them some of those things that are local. But then we really try to onboard them so that their nerves before our first day of in-service with all staff, which is second thing they get, is they've taken care of. They know where their rooms are. They know how to use all the basics. They have the technology, the nuts and bolts. And then we really start ramping up. How do I become effective in my classroom? If I'm a first-year teacher, that's another whole level. So how do you feel that you're not overwhelmed when those kids walk in the door the first day? If you've been a veteran teacher, how do we do things at Pines compared to where you've been before? We do a lot of listening with them more than with a brand new teacher. We're just checking in. We're making sure they're asking questions. We talk about supporting different learners. It's supporting different staff when they come on board. So it's systematic. After the first 90 days, it's a lot of check-ins. We do have a meeting early on, just what are the fires? What didn't we tell you that you want to know? We reach out to our mentors, not for any type of evaluation. We want a trust level there. It's more of, hey, what do they need? Do they need need some time? Do they need a different resource that we didn't give them in the first 30 days? How do we set up the next 30 days? So it's a lot of listening and checking in. But if things are going well, then we stick to our plan of checking in frequently, supporting their needs.
I like the wide-ranging aspect of that mentorship program. And I think one of the things that is often challenging about mentorship programs in general is that it's so vague in terms of what's expected. So I want to break this up into a couple of different components. Obviously, the logistical items and getting a new hire acclimated to all the logistical details, that's kind of table stakes. If you're an organization in a school district that isn't doing the table stakes logistical stuff, to definitely start doing that. But I want to dig into one element that you mentioned, which was classroom effectiveness and also just overall educator support. So let's tackle the classroom effectiveness component first. What are the structured elements of your mentorship program that speak to the classroom effectiveness component, getting those new teachers in the district highly effective in delivering classes to the students?
You want to think about it as a day in life of a teacher. We break those into chunks. How do I take attendance and how to do grading? Those are management mechanical things, but if you don't know how to do them, now the secretary's upset with you and others. So you want them to get kicked off to a great relationship. So we make sure they can function at a functional level. The high quality instruction comes with asking our mentors to actually go into their classrooms and feel safe to know that, hey, we're just going to help you through. If you have questions, give them, I think the challenge of the new teacher is giving them enough room to make mistakes, but then following up to make sure that it's not punitive. We're going to help you. If you have a class that's a challenge, maybe that's the one that your mentor drops into or a neighboring teacher. We do have instructional coaches where we'll send them in just to be like, hey, this is somebody you need to know. They're not going to give you evaluations at all. They don't do that. They are purely to help you become effective with the pieces that are research-based, but also innovations within our district. It's making sure they have the right people at the right time to build into a teacher. It takes, my experience would say, you need 3 years to really get to that highly effective. Some come out of the gates doing great things and we support them and help them grow. But everybody, even our veterans, use instructional coaches and getting better improvement cycles. So it feels natural. I can't overemphasize your professional learning community culture that you really want to have, because that's what embraces them and realizing, boy, these veterans are trying to help each other get better. So it's not just me that I'm struggling. I'm afraid to ask questions. We really watch for staff that don't ask questions because they're the ones that are drowning. They're either embarrassed or they don't know what's going on to ask the right questions. So there we backfill a little extra. We want our administrators walking through classrooms too. They're building relationships with and trust with that person. They're also keeping an eye on kids. They might be, hey, this group of kids is going to be a challenge. Let me give her some pointers based on prior experience. So it is a systematic, but it's really listening with your ears, watching with your eyes, and getting an overall where are we at, and then making sure if our system is working, let's keep it going, make sure it's being done. If it's not, what other what can we do to support that new person?
That's really good context. And I want to pick on one small piece of what you mentioned. And that was, we pay attention to the people that aren't asking questions. We want to create that professional learning culture, is I think what you described. I guess the question that I have is, what do you have your leadership team do that creates the type of environment where people are more willing to ask those questions out in the open?
Fellow educators, we have all of our jargon, right? So PLCs are pretty common. It's research-based. It's not a thing. It's a way of operations. I will emphasize, you're joining the Pines family. And if you really think of your own family, that's not always perfect. So we want to think that's all great. But the reality is, I have brothers and sisters, and sometimes we didn't get along, and or we didn't know what each other was doing. So that's the same thing in our culture here at school. We want to make sure they realize it's not always going to be perfect. We're going to have good days and bad days. And when they see the veterans also acknowledging it's okay to not have a perfect day, let's work together. My opening message this year was, we're going to get a little better each every day. We don't expect anybody to be perfect. So if I, as the leader, can acknowledge that, if a principal can do that, if a veteran teacher can do that, then it might be okay for me to do that. It's safe. We're really working in those first 90 days, as you referenced earlier, to build a safe culture, to ask questions, to make a mistake. I believe it takes 3 years to really get to be highly effective as a teacher. Some of our models from the state follow that same path, 3 years of growth. So we really want to build that where they are knowing that in the first 90 days, if they're not doing those things and not feeling safe, then we have to build that trust. We can't just keep saying it. We have to do it through our actions, through our supports. We do hear from their peers when they think, hey, just so you know, they're a little overwhelmed right now. Can we do something to help them? And then it's up to us to do the action part of, instead of just saying, feel safe. What can we do? Can we give them a little extra time? We have sent them out to, we have three campuses. So if we have an elementary teacher that maybe is a little overwhelmed in their building, let's send them out to one of the other buildings with maybe a rock star veteran who they can see what's going on in their classroom. They can take part of the day to breathe and observe, ask good questions to them, come back with some confidence and new ideas possibly.
You've referenced a couple of times making sure instructors or educators aren't overwhelmed, making sure that they have time to breathe or space to breathe. Walk us through a little bit of some of the things that you're doing on that front, because one of the things that are common within the K-12 education space is educator burnout. And that's actually a big reason why a lot of educators leave the profession, is because they're getting fried out. So what are the things that you've put into place as a district that guards against that and creates an environment where there's a little bit more space for educators to recharge and take care of their mental, physical, emotional well-being?
As a district leader, you acknowledge we got to always get better at it because we're not perfect. And I see it. I hear it. We still have staff. And I think you got to control the things you control. We know we have staff who have had some pretty significant trauma in their life. Loss of a spouse, loss of a parent, sick children, all kinds of things. Marriages maybe that aren't going as well. So we have to realize, what are the things we can control internally? When they're going through some of those, we do, just like most districts, have personal time. We encourage staff to use that when that would help. We also built for all staff a calendar where we try to have at least one professional learning day every month and almost a day off every month that isn't scheduled for professional development or for anything other than a day to spend with family or themselves, or how do they recharge their batteries, however they choose to do it. We do have some constraints in Wisconsin that make it challenging to build a school calendar like that. I've been researching the 4 day a week. We know there's some states doing that. Wisconsin, that's almost impossible, just the way the calendar law is set up. But we have tried to make the best of it. And a professional learning day, we don't structure the whole day. I think choice, how they use their time wisely to benefit them, how they spend their time, is really important to them to recharge their batteries. If it's relieving stress by being ready for class on Monday, not having to do it over the weekend, then that's a good thing. If it's, I want to work with a colleague that I'm struggling, but I know they can help me, then that's how they choose to use their time. So it's that balance of setting up a schedule. When we see a teacher, maybe, are they using our employee assistant plan? Can we give them a day where they can take time to do something else? Which is really challenging because we don't have a lot of subs and a lot of resources to do that. But there are times where maybe that is what they need. And we have to step in. Our administrative team constantly is having that conversation of, where are staff at? when is it best to back off maybe some of the professional growth? And when is it time to, hey, we're in a good spot. We can move forward. So it's reading the room, not it's a little bit of surveys, but it's also pulse checking by being in your building and being present.
Wow, it's been a great conversation so far. Make sure you join the HR Impact Community, where we gather a community of HR leaders just like you. This is a space where top people leaders share actionable insights and practical playbooks. Sign up today as a member for the community. Get updates on the latest HR resources and exclusive event invites. You can join the community at www.engagerocket.co/HR Impact. And now, back to the show.
One of the things that you're referencing is building in a certain level of flexibility within reason to help with some of these burnout factors. Tell us a little bit more about how you're embedding flexibility in some teacher-centric policies that are a hedge against some of these burnout items. What else are you doing within your district that drives better teacher well-being?
I think teachers want to own a lot of their professional life. They know we have structures. We have high outcomes. If you're going to be a high-performing district, you have to base research. You have to continuously improve. But that adds stress too. So that is something we're always challenging as leaders to balance. I think having choice in your professional development. So we have structured days with some things that we have to get done. We have to get better at teaching reading. At least part of that day, you have choice. We do have professional development dollars where they can choose. Do they want to go to workshops? Do they want to work on advanced degrees? Do they want to get new certifications so they can maybe take on different challenges when they hit those plateaus in their career? Do they want to be a coach or administrator or something different? Do they realize, hey, this will help charge my batteries. This is a new something forward to look forward to. It makes me keep being in the field of education. So we've tried to find a menu of that because it's not a one size fit all. And it's not a one size fit all where you're at in your career. That's the other component to professional growth. A veteran teacher that wants to keep growing doesn't want to do another master's, but they may want to get on a certification. So we got to have dollars that does all those things.
I like your approach, or at least your comment about you can't have a one size fits all approach. How would you apply that to a smaller school district in a rural environment that's probably not in the same situation as you are from a funding perspective? What are some of the lessons that can be drawn from that?
It is probably one of the largest challenges because there is a limited pie of money. And I think we talk about retention and supporting teachers. That's really comes down to, we all have to make tough decisions of where those dollars are going to go. And if you're going to put them in human capital, we know we got to keep our buildings so they don't leak and they maintain and all that. So it's really having a good plan of using your dollars wisely on the management side. But then where are you going to invest your dollars in with your people? Is it going to be where you want to spend it? Or is it a voice from them of, here's what we need to do, but where else could we have those dollars spent? Is it, we don't bring in a lot of big keynote speakers or a lot of one-off things. Those aren't good values to us. I'd rather give the dollars to individualize going to workshops or creating their own, giving them dollars to invest in self-led where they do maybe a peer group. We've done some choices with that. We've done with our support paraprofessionals who are strong educators as well. They have done book studies and done some of that in the summer after school by choice. They dictated what they wanted to learn, and then we gave them the dollars and money to do it. It's a combination of that. But you have to, as all strong leaders do, you have to start prioritizing dollars. And what you spend them on sends a lot of message. We obviously would love to pay more. We'd obviously love to have the even better benefits. How do we use those dollars in the PD side and give the choice of that menu for them to use them? Everybody's situation is a little unique and different, but I will just say that you have to send a strong message that we want to be continuously improving, so we're going to put some dollars there.
Now, I think if I'm summarizing what you're mentioning, everybody's got a competing list of priorities that they need to determine what to allocate finite resources to. And not to put words in your mouth, but what I heard from what you said is when in doubt, invest in your people, which sounds pretty simple, but that's really seems to be at the forefront of how you view your district and how those limited resources should be allocated. One of the things that stands out from the conversation that we had before we came into the show was the track record that your district had for teacher retention as well as development. And we talked a little bit about how you've emphasized professional development and how that plays into the role. Are there any other factors that come to mind that's really helped you be as successful as you are in not only retaining the educators that come into your district, but also developing them for the next level?
How we support them financially, I mentioned a lot of things that are really important, but ultimately they have to make a living to live here. In a rural area, some costs are a little less, but actually many of them are more because there's not the grocery costs and some of the other things. Thankfully, you can buy online has helped a lot in the last 10 years, but so you do have to pay them. How we view pay compared to our neighbors, compared to our region, I think looking at it a big scale, I can say, hey, you can live here, but they're not necessarily thinking that way. They might say, I could live 200 miles away and make more. I'm going to move. So I have to sell not only where you live as a great resource and asset, but I have to be in the ballpark. So we've had to become in the ballpark and do a lot of research on where the pay is. How do we distribute it is probably the bigger topic. In a competitive world, we used to have a pay-for-performance model, which was, as a marketing term, sounds great to some educators, and we actually drew educators to us because of that terminology. Hey, if I do a better job, you're going to pay me more? That's what everybody always wants, right? I'm going to work hard for you. I'm going to keep getting better. Pay me more. It sounds great, but when you have finite resources, and we don't come from a competitive mindset. If you're trying to build a culture where you're working together to get better and support one another, no matter what you put on paper and try to convince people that you're not competitive, that's what that model sends the message of. So we have switched to more of one where it's a dialogue, it's to support individuals and how they grow year by year. So we have seen a better and improvement in our culture since going away from that pay model. We've kept the dollars in it. It's just how you get though. They're not still given out freely. You have to earn them, but how you earn them is more about a process in the voice, their voice, versus it being a number system and jumping through hoops to earn more and more pay.
When I think about the conversation that we've had, and if the goal is to build a more collaborative culture, it makes sense that you would move away from a pay-for-performance culture because that tends to lead to mercenary type behavior, at least in the private sector. And I'm sure that factors in any sector if you orient it that way. One thing that I'm curious about, especially when we're looking at retention and development of teachers, you've been in this district for a while. You've been in the role for a while. How do you think that's influenced your ability to retain and develop the teachers and build that leadership pipeline within your district?
It's been huge. I've lived through multiple models in my career. The old Lane and Steps, which having been part of a union for a long time prior to becoming an administrator, I saw that from a strategic standpoint. I saw how do we take care of our faculty and our families to switching the gear and switching the hat to administrator who now figures out a way to distribute those dollars. We currently don't have a union here in our district, which I think has pros and cons in every as well. It is on me. You do get more of an individualized mindset like, hey, I'm going to be more advocacy for myself and my family. So how do I work with them and make this still see the bigger picture? Because now it's all on the district to paint that picture and talk about package and benefits and the value of all those things. So I think being listening, being transparent has been huge. The simple things, we make changes. How did we get to there? Was there any voice by staff? How do we make sure they know that we are still trying to find the best for them? We have to make sure we're doing the best for our students. And ultimately, we have to work and live. And you mentioned in the intro, we go to referendum, so we have to ask taxpayers for dollars, and those dollars, part of those go to salaries. So they know that we're out each time asking for money so we can retain and attract the best staff possible.
I like your comment about really being hands-on and listening and also doing whatever you can to retain the staff that you have. Part of the equation has to involve, I believe, developing a pathway for those educators in their careers. So tell us a little bit more about how you've developed creative pathways for those educators to expand their skills, maybe shift into new roles. What does that look like within your district?
Be very intentional as principals, directors, superintendents. When you see something, whether it's a very young teacher or maybe a veteran and giving them some confidence. If you recognize something and going up to them and saying, hey, have you thought about being an instructional coach? Have you thought about being a principal? Have you thought about starting a new school? And then if they are interested, that's how those systems we have in place with professional development and other systems, money and time. I have been all for sending people to, we have a great professional organizations as principals and district administrators where they have 1-day workshops. What's it like to be in this role? We'll give them a day to go do those things. We'll pay for it. Getting them out to see what an instructional coach is. So going and getting the training while they're working in their current role with the idea that maybe the opportunity will come in our district or not, but at least providing them to grow and try it out and be okay to say, you know what, that isn't for me. We have had multiple people gone through administration who thought they may want to be there. They completed it. And I will say they are better teachers and educational leaders in our district, but they're just not going to be interested in taking on that admin role, which is okay because I need strong educational leaders that aren't just by title as well in our district. So recognizing that we can support them in other roles that make them feel they are growing and getting over that hump of maybe doing the same thing over and over has been really powerful. But it starts with maybe somebody in-house. There are plenty that will say, hey, I'm going to go down this path. What can you do for me? But there's been a lot of us who have mentored. I would say use the word actually mentored, encourage them, show them the path. Why is it a good thing? And it's really a satisfying thing as a leader to do that.
So there's one aspect of that I'd like you to expand on a little bit. Obviously, finding and developing your pipeline of talent is easy when you have hand raisers. What about the people that aren't raising their hands, the ones that are flying under the radar? What are the steps that you've put into place where you and your admin team can identify those people that are sitting back a little bit that probably are interested, but don't have the courage to speak up?
So to grow as a district at a high level and have higher academic outcomes, because one of the things that I've been blessed to be part of is a district that believes in continuous improvement. One of the ways we're doing that very systematically now is we have a research-based practice. We have a district continuous improvement team and building continuous improvement teams, which then lead to those departments and or grade levels, however the building is structured. We encourage people to be part of those. We give them time out of their classroom to be part of those. We send them to some high-level professional development if they're part of those. So when they're in those, that's the way we've nudged some into that uncomfortable space, allowed them to realize, oh, I can practice and try it without having to feel like I'm failing because it's safe. I will also say we have sent some staff to some pretty high level training where it's 3 days in the summer or even during the school year where it's a day every couple months. Those car rides and those sessions afterwards have been very powerful. When you're sitting with somebody maybe in a non-structured setting and saying, hey, I really liked what you did. Have you thought about this? Or did you notice that the room was watching you more? Did you feel it? It's those small conversations outside the structure of those continuous improvement leadership teams that is really powerful. So us nudging people, we sent a group last summer, we sent 10 to a PLC Institute, it's called. It's in Madison, so it's in Wisconsin. It's a national level conference, but having some staff that maybe didn't see themselves as leader, we've seen some of them blossom as leaders within their in their department teams and in the building now. It's slow, but they got the nudge. They got the taste of it. They like to lead more than just by example now. They're maybe speaking up a little bit more. So that's been a concrete example of that's been really effective over my career here and even more intentional the last 5 to 6.
Really great conversation. And I think we covered a lot of ground that's relevant to rural school districts and some of the ways that rural school districts can really become a high-performing district. Now, when you think back over the entire course of the conversation, what are the key things that other leaders of rural school districts need to keep in mind so that they can actually build a district similar to yours? What are some things that you think people should be paying particular attention to?
Work at building trust. I think people, when they feel supported and they feel trust in their leadership, it goes a long ways. The other thing I would add, two other quick other ones is one, you got to have systematic approaches to these things. You can't be left to air, but it has to be a human element to it. So make sure you have a script and follow it, but also make sure it's authentic and make sure it's some people doing it. It's not just I'm reading, oh, we do this on Tuesday, so we're doing it. And the last thing is people change in their career. What a beginning teacher needs to what a veteran teacher needs, you have to have systems that are adaptable and flexible, and that comes with choice. So building that in that system of making sure that overseeing a group of people, not everybody at the same time needs the same thing. So being flexible enough to support a person wherever they're at in their journey in their career.
Great stuff, Scott. If people want to continue the conversation, what's the best way for them to get in touch with you?
Yeah, they can reach out and give me a call at my phone number, 715-891-1198, or by email, which is sfoster@npsd.k12.wi.us.
That's a mouthful. Thanks for hanging out with us, Scott. Really great stuff that you shared with us, and I really appreciate your time. When I think about the things that stood out to me in this conversation, there are some basic elements that I think every rural school district administrator can put into place that's going to have some significant impact on their ability to build a top school district. One of the key things, a couple of the key things that stand out immediately is your focus on the small things in building a community. So when you're a small district and you have limited resources and limited hands, you need to leverage the community power that you have and take an all hands on deck approach to make sure that anybody new coming into the district is feeling supported and welcome. And that's focusing on the small things, the things that you talked about when you're writing handwritten notes, making sure other members of the team are welcoming that person in, and then building a community around that individual before they're hired and then throughout that onboarding and first year process. I think that's really impactful. And regardless of resources, every district can do. The other thing that stands out about this conversation is your point about your people investment focus. So everybody's got limited resources available to them. So the question that a district superintendent or administrator needs to think about is, where am I going to allocate those resources? Is it going to be on things that I care about, or is it going to be on the people side of the equation that's going to level up each individual on my team and their ability to serve the students, their families, and their community? And I think how you make those decisions are going to have a great impact on your ability to better attract, retain, and develop your educators and build a top district. Really great stuff. I appreciate you sharing that. For those of you who have listened to this conversation, I appreciate you hanging out. If you like the conversation, make sure you leave us a review. And if you haven't already done so, make sure you join our HR Impact community. You can find that at www.engagerocket.co/HR Impact. And then tune in next time where we'll have another great leader joining us, sharing with us the game-changing insights that help them build high-performing teams. Thanks for listening to this episode of Engaging Leadership. We hope you liked the conversation. Don't forget to continue supporting us by joining the HR Impact community. You can find our community at www.engagerocket.co/HR Impact. Tune in next time where we'll have another leader joining us and sharing with us the game-changing insights that help them build high-performing teams.